nature and collective subconsciousness of most every inhabitant in order for a caste system to function. Pillar number one, divine will and the laws of nature. Before the age of human awareness, according to the ancient Hindu text of India, Manu the All-Knowing was seated in contemplation when the great men approached him and asked him, "Please, Lord, tell us precisely and in the proper order the laws of all the social classes, as well as of those born in between." Manu proceeded to tell of a time when the universe, as we know it, was in a deep sleep, and the one who is beyond the range of senses brought forth the waters and took birth himself as Brahma, the grandfather of all the worlds. And then to fill the land, he created the Brahmin, the highest caste, from his mouth, the Kshatriya from his arms, the Vaishya from his thighs, and from his feet, the Shudra, the lowest of the four varnas, or divisions of man, millennia ago and into the fullness of time. The fragment from which each caste was formed foretold the position that each would fill and their placement in order in the caste system. From lowest to highest, bottom to top, the Shudra, the feet, the servant, the bearer of burdens, the Vaishya, the thighs, the engine, the merchant, the trader, the Kshatriya, the arms, the warrior, the protector, the ruler, and above them all, the Brahmin, the head, the mouth, the philosopher, the sage, the priest, the one nearest to the gods. The Brahmin is by law the lord of this whole creation, according to the laws of Manu. It is by the kindness of the Brahmin that other people eat. Unmentioned among the original four varnas were those deemed so low that they were beneath even the feet of the Shudra. They were living out the afflicted karma of the past. They were not to be touched, and some not even to be seen. Their very shadow was a pollutant. They were outside of the caste system, and thus outcasts. These were the untouchables, who would later come to be known as Dalits, the subordinate caste of India. In the words of the sacred text of the Western world, the Old Testament, there had been a great flood. The windows of heaven had opened, along with the fountains of the deep, and all of humankind was said to have descended from the three sons of the patriarch Noah. By divine instruction, they survived the floodwaters in an ark for more than 40 days and 40 nights, and thereafter, Noah became a man of the soil. His sons were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who would become the progenitors of all humanity. One season, Noah planted a vineyard, and he later drank of the wine of the fruit of the vineyard. The wine overtook him, and he lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, who would become the father of a son, Canaan, happened into the tent and saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. They walked backward into the tent and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned in the other direction, so that they would not see their father unclothed. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what Ham had done, he cursed Ham's son Canaan and the generations to follow, saying, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." The story of Ham's discovery of Noah's nakedness would pass down through the millennia. The sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth spread across the continents, Shem to the east, Ham to the south, Japheth to the west, it was said. Those who decreed themselves the descendants of Japheth would hold fast to that story and translate it to their advantage. As the riches from the slave trade from Africa to the New World poured forth to the Spaniards, to the Portuguese, to the Dutch, and lastly to the English, the biblical passage would be summoned to condemn the children of Ham and to justify the kidnap and enslavement of millions of human beings, and the violence against them. From the time of the Middle Ages, some interpreters of the Old Testament described Ham as bearing black skin and translated Noah's curse against him as a curse against the descendants of Ham, against all humans with dark skin, the people who the Europeans told themselves had been condemned to enslavement by God's emissary, Noah himself. They found further comfort in Leviticus, which exhorted them, "Both thy bondmen and thy bondmaids, which thou shalt have, shall be of the heathen that are round about you. Of them shall ye buy bondmen and bondmaids." This they took as further license to enslave those they considered religious heathens to build a new country out of wilderness. And thus, a hierarchy evolved in the new world they created, one that set those with the lightest skin above those with the darkest. Those who were darkest and those who descended from those who were darkest would be assigned to the subordinate caste of America for centuries. The curse of Ham is now being executed upon his descendants, Thomas R. R. Cobb, a leading Confederate and defender of slavery, wrote 240 years into the era of human bondage in America. The great architect had framed them both physically and mentally to fill the sphere in which they were thrown. His wisdom and mercy combined in constituting them thus, suited to the degraded position they were destined to occupy. Slavery officially ended in 1865, but the structure of caste remained intact, not only surviving, but hardening. "Let the Negro have the crumbs that fall from the white man's table," Thomas Pierce Bailey, a 20th century author, recorded in his list of the caste codes of the American South, echoing the Indian laws of Manu. The United States and India would become, respectively, the oldest and the largest democracies in human history, both built on caste systems undergirded by their reading of the sacred texts of their respective cultures. In both countries, the subordinate castes were consigned to the bottom, seen as deserving of their debasement, owing to the sins of the past. These tenets, as interpreted by those who put themselves on high, would become the divine and spiritual foundation for the belief in a human pyramid willed by God, a great chain of being that the founders would further sculpt in the centuries to follow as circumstances required. And so we have what could be called the first pillar of caste, divine will and the laws of nature, the first of the organizing principles inherent in any caste system. Pillar number 2, heritability. To work, each caste society relied on clear lines of demarcation in which everyone was ascribed a rank at birth and a role to perform, as if each person were a molecule in a self-perpetuating organism. You were born to a certain caste and remained in that caste, subject to the high status or low stigma it conferred for the rest of your days and into the lives of your descendants. Thus, heritability became the second pillar of caste. In India, it was generally the father who passed his rank to his children. In America, dating back to colonial Virginia, children inherited the caste of their mother both by law and by custom. And in disputes beyond these parameters, a child was generally to take the status of the lower-ranking parent. The Virginia General Assembly declared the status of all people born in the colony. "Whereas some doubts have arisen whether children got by any Englishman upon a Negro woman should be slave or free," the Assembly decreed in 1662, "be it therefore enacted and declared by this present Grand Assembly, that all children born in this country shall be held bond or free only according to the condition of the mother." With this decree, the colonists were breaking from English legal precedent, the only precepts they had ever known, the ancient order that gave children the status of the father. This new law allowed enslavers to claim the children of black women, the vast majority of whom were enslaved, as their property for life and for ensuing generations. It invited them to impregnate the women themselves, if so inclined. The richer it would make them. It converted the black womb into a profit center and drew sharper lines around the subordinate caste, as neither mother nor child could make a claim against an upper caste man, and no child springing from a black womb could escape condemnation to the lowest rung. It moved the colonies toward a bipolar hierarchy of whites and non-whites, and specifically, a conjoined caste of whites at one end of the ladder, and at the other end, those deemed black due to any physical manifestation of African ancestry. Tied conveniently as it was to what one looked like, membership in either the upper or the lower caste was deemed immutable, primordial, fixed from birth to death, and thus regarded as inescapable. "He may neither earn nor wed his way out," wrote the scholars Alison Davis and Burley and Mary Gardner in Deep South, their seminal 1941 study of caste in America. It is the fixed nature of caste that distinguishes it from class, a term to which it is often compared. Class is an altogether separate measure of one's standing in a society, marked by level of education, income, and occupation, as well as the attendant characteristics such as accent, taste, and manners that flow from socioeconomic status. These can be acquired through hard work and ingenuity, or lost through poor decisions or calamity. If you can act your way out of it, then it is class, not caste. Through the years, wealth and class may have insulated some people born to the subordinate caste in America, but not protected them from humiliating attempts to put them in their place or to remind them of their caste position. Centuries after the American caste system took shape along the Chesapeake, the most accomplished of lower caste people have often found ways to transcend caste, but rarely to fully escape it. Like the Hindu caste system, the black-white distinction in the United States has supplied a social hierarchy determined at birth and arguably immutable even by achievement, wrote the legal scholars Raymond T. Diamond and Robert J. Cottrell. Blacks became like a group of American untouchables, ritually separated from the rest of the population. In the winter of 2013, the Academy Award-winning actor Forrest Whitaker, a distinguished, middle-aged African-American man, walked into a gourmet delicatessen on the west side of Manhattan for a bite to eat. Seeing it crowded, or not finding what he wanted, he turned to leave without making a purchase, as many customers might. An employee thought it suspicious and blocked him at the door. That level of intervention was uncharacteristic at an establishment frequented by celebrities and college students. The employee frisked him up and down in front of other customers. Finding nothing, he allowed Whitaker, visibly shaken, to leave. The delicatessen owners later apologized for the incident and fired the employee. But the degradation of that moment stayed with the actor. "It's a humiliating thing for someone to come and do that," Whitaker said afterward. "It's attempted disempowerment." Neither wealth nor celebrity has insulated those born to the subordinate caste from the police brutality that seems disproportionately trained on those at the bottom of the hierarchy. In 2015, New York City police officers broke an NBA player's leg outside of a nightclub in Manhattan. The injury left the player, a forward for the Atlanta Hawks, disabled for the rest of the season. It resulted in a $4 million settlement, the proceeds of which the player promptly said he would donate to a foundation for public defenders. In 2018, police officers slammed a former NFL player to the ground after a disagreement he had with another motorist who had thrown coffee at his car, according to news reports. The video that surfaced that spring shows officers twisting Desmond Marrow's arms and legs and shoving him face down onto the pavement. Then they turn him over and hold him down by the throat. He passes out under their weight. After the video went viral, an internal investigation was conducted and an officer was fired. No matter how great you become in life, no matter how wealthy you become, how people worship you, or what you do, NBA star LeBron James told reporters just the year before, if you are an African-American man or African-American woman, you will always be that. Pillar number 3, endogamy and the control of marriage and mating. The framers of the American caste system took steps early in its founding to keep the castes separate and to seal off the bloodlines of those assigned to the upper rung. This desire led to the third pillar of caste, endogamy, which means restricting marriage to people within the same caste. This is an ironclad foundation of any caste system, from ancient India to the early American colonies to the Nazi regime in Germany. Endogamy was brutally enforced in the United States for the vast majority of its history and did the spade work for current ethnic divisions. Endogamy enforces caste boundaries by forbidding marriage outside of one's group and going so far as to prohibit sexual relations or even the appearance of romantic interest across caste lines. It builds a firewall between castes and becomes the primary means of keeping resources and affinity within each tier of the caste system. Endogamy, by closing off legal family connection, blocks the chance for empathy or a sense of shared destiny between the castes. It makes it less likely that someone in the dominant caste will have a personal stake in the happiness, fulfillment, or well-being of anyone deemed beneath them, or personally identify with them or their plight. Endogamy, in fact, makes it more likely that those in the dominant caste will see those deemed beneath them as not only less than human, but as an enemy, as not of their kind, and as a threat that must be held in check at all costs. Caste, wrote Bhimrao Ambedkar, the father of the anti-caste movement in India, means an artificial chopping off of the population into fixed and definite units, each one prevented from fusing into another through the custom of endogamy. Thus, in showing how endogamy is maintained, he added, we shall practically have proved the genesis and also the mechanism of caste. Before there was a United States of America, there was endogamy, said to be ordained by God. One of the earliest references to what would come to be known as race in America arose over the matter of sexual relations between a European and an African. In 1630, the Virginia General Assembly sentenced Hugh Davis to a public whipping for having abused himself to the dishonor of God and the shame of Christians by defiling his body in lying with a Negro. The assembly went to the trouble of specifying that Africans, who might not normally be permitted to observe the punishment of a dominant caste man, had to attend and witness the whipping of Davis. This served a dual function in the emerging caste system. It further humiliated Davis before an audience of people deemed beneath him, and it signaled a warning to those being banished to the lowest caste in a country that did not yet even exist. If this was the fate of a white man who did not adhere to caste boundaries, so much worse will it be for you. By the time of Davis's sentencing, European men had been having sex with African women, often without consent or consequence to themselves, throughout the era of the slave trade, and had grown accustomed to acting upon their presumed sovereignty over Africans. So for the colonial fathers to condemn Hugh Davis to public humiliation for behavior that many took as a birthright meant that he had crossed a line they found threatening to the hierarchy. Something about the way he related to his mate that got their attention and required their intervention. The emerging caste system permitted the exploitation of the lowest caste, but not equality or the appearance of equality, which is why endogamy, which confers an alliance between equals in the eyes of the law, was strictly policed, and rape of lower caste women ignored. The case of Hugh Davis was not only the first mention of race and hierarchy in America, but also the first attempt at setting the boundaries of publicly known relationships across caste lines. 10 years later, another white man, Robert Sweet, was forced to do penance when it came to light that he had gotten an enslaved black woman owned by another white man pregnant. By then, the focus of caste enforcement had shifted. In that case, it was the pregnant woman who was whipped, a sign of her degraded caste status, despite a medical condition that would have protected her in most civilized nations. In 1691, Virginia became the first colony to outlaw marriage between blacks and whites, a ban that the majority of states would take up for the next 3 centuries. Some states forbade the marriage of whites to Asians or Native Americans, in addition to African Americans, who were uniformly excluded. While there was never a single nationwide ban on intermarriage, despite several attempts to enact one, 41 of the 50 states passed laws making intermarriage a crime, punishable by fines of up to $5,000 and up to 10 years in prison. Some states went so far as to forbid the passage of any future law permitting intermarriage. Outside of the law, particularly in the South, African Americans faced penalty of death for even the appearance of breaching this pillar of caste. The Supreme Court did not overturn these prohibitions until 1967. Still, some states were slow to officially repeal their endogamy laws. Alabama, the last state to do so, did not throw out its law against intermarriage until the year 2000. Even then, 40% of the electorate in that referendum voted in favor of keeping the marriage ban on the books. It was the caste system, through the practice of endogamy, essentially state regulation of people's romantic choices over the course of centuries, that created and reinforced races by permitting only those with similar physical traits to legally mate. Combined with bans on immigrants who were not from Europe for much of American history, endogamy laws had the effect of controlled breeding, of curating the population of the United States. This form of social engineering served to maintain the superficial differences upon which the hierarchy was based, race ultimately becoming the result of who was officially allowed to procreate with whom. Endogamy ensures the very difference that a caste system relies on to justify inequality. "What we look like," wrote the legal scholar Ian Haney Lopez, "the literal and racial features we in this country exhibit, is to a large extent the product of legal rules and decisions." This pillar of caste was well enough understood and accepted that as late as 1958, a Gallup poll found that 94% of white Americans disapproved of marriage across racial lines. "You know the Negro race is inferior mentally," a Southern physician told researchers back in 1940, expressing a commonly held view. "Everyone knows that, and I don't think God meant for a superior race like the whites to blend with an inferior race." As this was the prevailing sentiment for most of the country's history, an unknowable number of lives were lost due to this defining pillar of caste, the presumed breach of which triggered the most publicized cases of lynchings in America. The protocol was strictly enforced against lower caste men and upper caste women, while upper caste men, the people who wrote the laws, kept full and flagrant access to lower caste women, whatever their age or marital status. In this way, the dominant gender of the dominant caste, in addition to controlling the livelihood and life chances of everyone beneath them, eliminated the competition for its own women, and in fact, for all women. For much of American history, dominant caste men controlled who had access to whom for romantic liaisons and reproduction. This inverted the natural expression of manhood, total freedom for one group and life or death policing of another, and served further to reinforce caste boundaries and the powerlessness of subordinated men who might dare try to protect their own daughters, wives, sisters, and mothers. At the same time, it reminded everyone in the hierarchy of the absolute power of dominant caste men. This was a cloud that hung over the lives of everyone consigned to the lowest caste for most of the time that there has been a United States of America. In the mid-1830s in Grand Gulf, Mississippi, white men burned a black man alive and stuck his head on a pole at the edge of town for all to see as a lesson to men in the subordinate caste. The black man had been tortured and beheaded after he stood up and killed the dominant caste man who owned his wife and was in the habit of sleeping with her, according to a contemporaneous account. As he faced death for taking an extreme and assuredly suicidal step to protect his wife in that world, the doomed husband said that he believed he should be rewarded in heaven for it. More than a century later, in December 1943, an earnest 15-year-old boy named Willie James Howard was working during the holiday school break at a dime store in Live Oak, Florida. He was an only child, and having made it to the 10th grade, was expected to exceed what anyone else in the family had been able to accomplish. That December, he made a fateful gesture, unknowing or unmindful of a central pillar of caste. He was hopeful and excited about his new job and wanted so badly to do well that he sent Christmas cards to everyone at work. In one Christmas card, the one to a girl his age named Cynthia who worked there and whom he had a crush on, he signed with L for love. It would seem an ordinary gesture for that time of the year, sweet even, but this was the Jim Crow South. The boy was black and the girl was white. She showed the card to her father. Word got back to Willie James that his card had somehow disturbed her. So on New Year's Day, 1944, he hand-delivered an apologetic note trying to explain himself. "I know you don't think much of our kind of people, but we don't hate you. All we want is to be your friends, but you won't let us. Please don't let anybody else see this. I hope I haven't made you mad." He added a rhyme. "I love your name, I love your voice. For a S.H., sweetheart, you are my choice." The next day, the girl's father and two other white men dragged Willie James and his father to the banks of the Suwannee River. They hogtied Willie James and held a gun to his head. They forced him to jump and forced his father at gunpoint to watch him drown. Held captive and outnumbered as the father was, he was helpless to save his only child. The men admitted to authorities that they had abducted the boy and bound his hands and feet. They said he just jumped and drowned on his own. Within days, the boy's parents fled for their lives. A young Thurgood Marshall of the NAACP alerted the Florida governor to no avail. The NAACP field secretary, Harry T. Moore, managed to convince the boy's parents to overcome their terror and to sign affidavits about what had happened the day their son was killed. A local grand jury refused to indict the boy's abductors, and federal prosecutors would not intervene. No one was ever held to account or spent a day in jail for the death of Willie James. His abduction and death were seen as upholding the caste order. Thus, the terrors of the Southern caste system continued, carried forth without penalty. Sanctioned as it was by the U.S. government, the caste system had become not simply Southern, but American. Pillar number 4, purity versus pollution. The fourth pillar of caste rests upon the fundamental belief in the purity of the dominant caste and the fear of pollution from the castes deemed beneath it. Over the centuries, the dominant caste has taken extreme measures to protect its sanctity from the perceived taint of the lower castes. Both India and the United States, at the zenith of their respective caste systems and the short-lived but heinous regime of the Nazis, raised the obsession with purity to a high, if absurdist, art. In some parts of India, the lowest caste people were to remain a certain number of paces from any dominant caste person while walking out in public, somewhere between 12 and 96 steps away, depending on the castes in question. They had to wear bells to alert those deemed above them so as not to pollute them with their presence. A person in the lowest sub-castes in the Maratha region had to drag a thorny branch with him to wipe out his footprints and prostrate himself on the ground if a Brahmin passed, so that his foul shadow might not defile the holy Brahmin. Touching or drawing near to anything that had been touched by an untouchable was considered polluting to the upper castes and required rituals of purification for the high caste person following this misfortune. This they might do by bathing at once in flowing water or performing pranayama breaths along with meditation to cleanse themselves of the pollutants. In Germany, the Nazis banned Jewish residents from stepping onto the beaches at the Jews' own summer homes, as at Wannsee, a resort suburb of Berlin, and at public pools in the Reich. They believed the entire pool would be polluted by immersion in it of a Jewish body, Jean-Paul Sartre once observed. In the United States, the subordinate caste was quarantined in every sphere of life, made untouchable on American terms for most of the country's history and well into the 20th century. In the South, where most people in the subordinate caste were long consigned, black children and white children studied from separate sets of textbooks. In Florida, the books for black children and white children could not even be stored together. African Americans were prohibited from using white water fountains and had to drink from horse troughs in the southern swelter before the era of separate fountains. In southern jails, the bed sheets for the black prisoners were kept separate from the bed sheets for the white prisoners. All private and public human activities were segregated from birth to death, from hospital wards to railroad platforms to ambulances, hearses, and cemeteries. In stores, black people were prohibited from trying on clothing, shoes, hats, or gloves, assuming they were permitted in the store at all. If a black person happened to die in a public hospital, the body will be placed in a corner of the dead house, away from the white corpses, wrote the historian Bertram Doyle in 1937. This pillar of caste was enshrined into law in the United States in 1896, after a New Orleans man challenged an 1890 Louisiana law that separated the white and colored races in railroad cars. Louisiana had passed the law after the collapse of Reconstruction and the return to power of the former Confederates. A committee of concerned citizens of color came together and raised money to fight the law in court. On the appointed day, June 7, 1892, Homer A. Plessy, a shoemaker who looked white but was categorized as black under the American definition of race, bought a first-class ticket from New Orleans to Covington on the East Louisiana Railroad and took his seat in the White's only car. In that era, a person of ambiguous racial origin was presumed not to be white, so the conductor ordered him to the colored car. Plessy refused and was arrested, as the committee had anticipated. His case went to the Supreme Court, which ruled 7-1 in favor of Louisiana's separate but equal law. It set in motion nearly 7 decades of formal, state-sanctioned isolation and exclusion of one caste from the other in the United States. In Southern courtrooms, even the Word of God was segregated. There were 2 separate Bibles, one for blacks and one for whites, to swear to tell the truth on. The same sacred object could not be touched by hands of different races. This pillar of purity, as with the others, endangered the lives of the people in the subordinate caste. One day in the 1930s, a black railroad switchman was working in Memphis and slipped and fell beneath a switch engine. He lay bleeding to death, his right arm and leg severed. Ambulances rushed to the man's aid, according to reports of the incident. They took one look, saw that he was a Negro, and backed away. The sanctity of water. The waters and shorelines of nature were forbidden to the subordinate castes if the dominant caste so desired. Well into the 20th century, African Americans were banned from white beaches and lakes and pools, both north and south, lest they pollute them, just as Dalits were forbidden from the waters of the Brahmins and Jews from Aryan waters in the Third Reich. This was a sacred principle in the United States well into the second half of the 20th century, and the dominant caste went to great lengths to enforce it. In the early 1950s, when Cincinnati agreed under pressure to allow black swimmers into some of its public pools, whites threw nails and broken glass into the water to keep them out. In the 1960s, a black civil rights activist tried to integrate a public pool by swimming a lap and then emerging to towel off. The response was to drain the pool entirely, wrote the legal historian Mark S. Weiner, and refill it with fresh water. Decades before, in 1919, a black boy paid with his life and set off a riot in Chicago for inadvertently breaching this pillar of caste. 17-year-old Eugene Williams was swimming in Lake Michigan at a public beach on the city's south side and happened to wade past the imaginary line that separated the races. He unknowingly passed into the white water, which flowed into and looked no different from the black water. He was stoned and drowned to death for doing so. The tensions over the breaching of boundaries that summer incited the dominant caste and set off one of the worst race riots in U.S. history. In the decades after, in Middle American places like Newton, Kansas, and Marion, Indiana, in Pittsburgh and St. Louis, people in the upper caste rose up in hysterics at the sight of a subordinate caste person approaching their water. In August 1931, a new public park opened in Pittsburgh, with pools the size of a football field and big enough for 10,000 swimmers. But soon afterward, as the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported, each Negro who entered the pool yesterday was immediately surrounded by whites and slugged or held beneath the water until he gave up his attempts to swim and left. In the summer of 1949, the city of St. Louis had what was considered the largest city pool in the country at its fairground park. When the city, under pressure from black citizens, took up the issue of allowing black people into the pool, the backlash was immediate. A man who happened to have the same name as the official in charge of integrating the pool required police protection due to the mistaken threats against him. Lifeguards considered quitting in protest. The day the first African Americans arrived to swim, a crowd gathered with knives, bricks, and bats. They set upon the black children who had come to swim, forcing them to walk a gauntlet, striking and taunting them. The mob grew to 5,000 people, who chased after any black person they saw approaching the park. Children on bicycles, a man stepping off a streetcar, a truck stalled in traffic, a black man on a porch at a house next to the park. They kicked him as he lay on the ground, limp and bleeding. The town of Newton, Kansas, went to the state Supreme Court to keep black people out of the pool it built in 1935. The city and its contractor argued that black people could never be permitted in the pool, not on alternate days, not at separate hours, not ever, because of the type of pool it was. They told the court that it was a circulatory type of pool in which the water is only changed once during the swimming season. White people, they argued, would not go into the water that had touched black skin. The only way white residents would swim in a pool after blacks, wrote the historian Jeff Wiltz, was if the water was drained and the tank scrubbed. The operators couldn't do all that every time a black person went into the pool, so they banned black people altogether. The court sided with the city, and for decades more, the town's only public pool remained for the exclusive use of the dominant caste. A public pool outside Pittsburgh solved this problem by keeping black people out until after the season was over in September, which meant it was closed to black swimmers at the precise time that they or anyone else would have wanted to use it. The manager said this was the only way the maintenance crew could get sufficient time to properly cleanse and disinfect it after the Negroes have used it. A white woman in Marion, Indiana, seemed to be speaking for many in the dominant caste across America when she said that white people wouldn't swim with colored people because they didn't want to be polluted by their blackness. Far from her, in Elizabeth, New Jersey, whites blocked African Americans at the stairwells and entrances the week the city first allowed black swimmers to its public pool. There and elsewhere, every black swimmer that entered the water quite literally risked his or her life, Wiltz wrote. It was in this atmosphere in 1951 that a Little League baseball team in Youngstown, Ohio, won the city championship. The coaches, unthinkingly, decided to celebrate with a team picnic at a municipal pool. When the team arrived at the gate, a lifeguard stopped one of the Little Leaguers from entering. It was Al Bright, the only black player on the team. His parents had not been able to attend the picnic, and the coaches and some of the other parents tried to persuade the pool officials to let the little boy in, to no avail. The only thing the lifeguards were willing to do was to let them set a blanket for him outside the fence and to let people bring him food. He was given little choice and had to watch his teammates splash in the water and chase each other on the pool deck while he sat alone on the outside. From time to time, one or another of the players or adults came out and sat with him before returning to join the others. His childhood friend, the author Mel Watkins, would write years later. It took an hour or so for a team official to finally convince the lifeguards that they should at least allow the child into the pool for a few minutes. The supervisor agreed to let the little leaguer in, but only if everyone else got out of the water, and only if Al followed the rules they set for him. First, everyone, meaning his teammates, the parents, all the white people, had to get out of the water. Once everyone cleared out, Al was led to the pool and placed in a small rubber raft, Watkins wrote. A lifeguard got into the water and pushed the raft with Al in it for a single turn around the pool, as 100 or so teammates, coaches, parents, and onlookers watched from the sidelines. After the agonizing few minutes that it took to complete the circle, Al was then escorted to his assigned spot on the other side of the fence. During his short time in the raft, as it glided on the surface, the lifeguard warned him over and over again of one important thing. "Just don't touch the water," the lifeguard said, as he pushed the rubber float. "Whatever you do, don't touch the water." The lifeguard managed to keep the water pure that day, but a part of that little boy died that afternoon. When one of the coaches offered him a ride home, he declined. With champion trophy in hand, Watkins wrote, "Al walked the mile or so back home by himself. He was never the same after that." The hierarchy of trace amounts: Griff's, Mahabon, and Songmele. The American caste system was an accelerated one, compressed into a fraction of the time that India's caste system has been in existence. Its founders used the story of Noah and his sons to justify the bottom of the hierarchy, but without further biblical instruction, as in the laws of Manu, they shaped the upper caste as they went along. This policing of purity in the United States began with the task of defining the dominant caste itself. While all the countries in the New World created hierarchies with Europeans on top, the United States alone created a system based on racial absolutism, the idea that a single drop of African blood or varying percentages of Asian or Native American blood could taint the purity of someone who might otherwise be presumed to be European, a stain that would thus disqualify the person from admittance to the dominant caste. This was a punitive model of racial superiority, as opposed to the South African model, which rewarded those with any proximity to whiteness and created an official mid-caste of colored people as a buffer between black and white. South Africa granted privileges on a graded scale based on how much European blood was thought to be coursing through one's veins, seeing white blood as a cleansing antiseptic to that of lowlier groups in the purity pollution paradigm. Both were forms of white supremacy crafted to fit the demographics of each country. South Africa's white minority had an incentive to grow its power and numbers by granting honorary whiteness to those deemed close enough. The white majority in the United States had no such incentive, and, in fact, benefited by elevating itself and holding those fewer in number apart and beneath them to serve as their subordinates. Degradation resulting from the taint of blood adheres to the descendants of Ham in this country like the poisoned tunic of Nessus, wrote Joseph Henry Lumpkin, the antebellum Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court, managing to combine Greek mythology and two pillars of caste, divine will and pollution, into a single ruling. The mythical tunic was the blood-soaked garment of the fallen centaur Nessus, which came to represent inescapable misfortune and ruin to those who wore it. The founders labored from the start over who should be allowed into the dominant caste. The vast majority of human beings, including many who are now considered white, would not have fit their definition. 25 years before the American Revolution, Benjamin Franklin worried that, with its growing German population, Pennsylvania would become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us, instead of our Anglifying them, and will never adopt our language or customs any more than they can acquire our complexion. Ultimately, the dominant caste used immigration and marriage law to control who could join its ranks and who would be excluded. That took constant redefinition. The law could not separate what it failed to categorize, wrote the legal scholars Raymond T. Diamond and Robert J. Cottrell. A legally mandated caste system needed, at a minimum, to define caste membership. At first, Congress in 1790 restricted American citizenship to white immigrants, free white persons, according to the statute. But whiteness had yet to be settled, and by the mid-19th century, with millions of people immigrating from Germany and fleeing famine in Ireland, supremacists on both sides of the Atlantic fretted over what was to become of a country flooded by the most degenerate races of olden day Europe, in the words of Arthur de Gobineau, a widely read 19th century advocate of Aryan supremacy. They are the human flotsam of all ages, Irish, crossbred Germans and French, and Italians of even more doubtful stock. For most of American history, anyone not Anglo-Saxon fell somewhere on a descending scale of human pollution. Like a field marshal defending his flanks in multiple theaters, the dominant caste fought the tainted influx of new immigrants with two of the most stringent immigration bans ever enacted, just before and after the turn of the 20th century. The country tried to block the flow of Chinese immigrants into the Western states with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Then it turned to the immigrants arriving from Southern and Eastern Europe, the scum and offscouring, as a former Virginia governor put it. Newcomers, who purportedly brought crime and disease and polluted the bloodlines of America's original white stock. Congress commissioned an analysis of the crisis, an influential document known as the Dillingham Report, and the House Committee on Immigration and Naturalization called hearings as the United States tried to further curate its population. The moral fiber of the nation has been weakened, and its very lifeblood vitiated by the influx of this tide of Oriental scum, Reverend M.D. Licklider, a minister from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, said in his testimony before the committee in 1910. Our grand Anglo-Saxon character must be preserved, and the pure unmixed blood flowing down from our Aryan progenitors must not be mixed with the Iberic race, a term applied to Southern Italians in the era of eugenics. The findings set the stage for the 1924 Immigration Act, which restricted immigration to quotas based on the demographics of 1890, that is, before Poles, Jews, Greeks, Italians, and others outside of Western Europe had arrived in great numbers. Their status contested, these groups were not always extended the protections accorded to unassailably white people. Not then, anyway. There was an attempt to exclude Italian voters from white primaries in Louisiana in 1903. The decade before, in 1891, 11 Italian immigrants in New Orleans lost their lives in one of the largest mass lynchings in American history, after the police chief was assassinated and the immigrants were seen as the prime suspects. After the lynching, hundreds more were rounded up and arrested. One of the organizers of the lynch mob, John M. Parker, later described Italians as just a little worse than the Negro, being, if anything, filthier in their habits, lawless, and treacherous. He went on to be elected governor of Louisiana. Later in 1922, a black man in Alabama named Jim Rawlins was convicted of miscegenation for living as the husband of a white woman named Edith LeBue. But when the court learned that the woman was Sicilian and saw no competent evidence that she was white, the judge reversed the conviction. The uncertainty surrounding whether she was conclusively white led the court to take the extraordinary step of freeing a black man who in other circumstances might have faced a lynching had she been seen as a white woman. By then, a majority of the states had devised or were in the process of devising ever more tortured definitions of white and black. Arkansas first defined Negro as one in whom there is a visible and distinct admixture of African blood. Then in 1911, the state changed it to anyone who has any Negro blood whatever, as it made interracial sex a felony. The state of Alabama defined a black person as anyone with a drop of Negro blood in its intermarriage ban. Oregon defined as non-white any person with one-quarter Negro, Chinese, or any person having one-quarter Negro, Chinese, or Kanaka blood, or more than one-half Indian blood. North Carolina forbade marriage between whites and any person of Negro or Indian descent to third generation inclusive. The state of Georgia defined white to mean no ascertainable trace of Negro, African, West Indian, Asiatic blood. Louisiana had a law on the books as recently as 1983, setting the boundary at 1/32nd Negro blood. Louisiana culture went to great specificity, not so unlike the Indian laws of Manu, in delineating the various subcastes based on the estimated percentage of African blood. There was Griff, 3/4 black, Mahabon, 5/8 black, mulatto, 1/2, quadroon, 1/4, octoroon, 1/8, sextaroon, 1/16, Demi Mayameluk, 1/32nd, and Songmele, 1/64th. The latter categories, as 21st century genetic testing has now shown, would encompass millions of Americans now classified as Caucasian. All of these categories bear witness to a historic American dominant caste preoccupation with race and caste purity. Virginia went all in and passed what it called the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, which, besides prohibiting interracial marriage, defined a white person as one who has no trace whatsoever of any blood other than Caucasian. The traceable amount was meant to ensure that even blacks who did not look black were kept in their place, wrote Diamond and Cottrell. Tracing black ancestry as far back as possible became a prerequisite to the smooth functioning of the caste system. The trials of the middle castes, the race to get under the white tent. By extending the dream of dominion over the land and all others in it to anyone who could meet the definition of white, the American caste system became an all-or-nothing gambit for the top rung. Which is why, when Ybor City, Florida, began segregating its streetcars in 1905, Cubans, who had been uncertain as to how they would be classified, were relieved and overjoyed to discover that they were allowed to sit in the white section. Those permitted under the white tent could reap the rewards of full citizenship, rise to positions of high status or as far as their talents could take them, get access to the best the country had to offer, or, at the very least, be accorded respect in everyday interactions from subordinate groups who risked assault for any misstep. A two-tiered caste system raised the stakes for whiteness, leading to court dockets filled with people on the borderline seeking admission to the upper caste. A Japanese immigrant named Takao Azawa had lived in the United States for more than 20 years. He tried to make the case that he was worthy of citizenship and should qualify as white because his skin was lighter than that of many white people. He argued, what really was the difference? How could he not be white if his skin was white? What did it mean to be white if someone with actual white skin was not white? His case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1922, the court held unanimously that white meant not skin color, but Caucasian, and that Japanese were not Caucasian, notwithstanding the fact that few white Americans had origins in the Caucasus Mountains of Russia either, and that those who did were at that very moment being kept out too. After the ruling, a newspaper that catered to Japanese immigrants, mocked the decision. Since this newspaper did not believe whites are the superior race, it is delighted the High Tribunal did not find the Japanese to be free white persons. A few months later, an immigrant from the dominant caste of India sought to make common cause with his upper caste counterparts in America when his application for citizenship made it to the Supreme Court. Bhagat Singh Tin argued that he was Caucasian, Aryan in fact, descended from the same stock as Europeans, given that it was widely held that Aryans migrated south to India and formed that country's upper caste. It could be said that he had a more rightful claim to being Caucasian than the people judging him. After all, the Caucasus Mountains were next to Iran and closer to neighboring India than to Western Europe. The court did not agree and rejected Tin's quest for citizenship in 1923. It may be true that the blonde Scandinavian and the brown Hindu have a common ancestor in the dim reaches of antiquity, wrote the court. But the average man knows perfectly well that there are unmistakable and profound differences between them today. These decisions were a heartbreaking catastrophe for Asians seeking citizenship. With pro-Western European sentiment running high, the government began rescinding the naturalized citizenship of people of Asian descent who were already here. This amounted to an abandonment of people who had lived legally in the United States for most of their adult lives, as would echo a century later with immigrants crossing the southern U.S. border with Mexico. It could lead to tragic consequences. Vaishno Das Bagai, an Indian immigrant, had been in the United States for 8 years by the time the Supreme Court ruled that Indians were not white and thus were ineligible for citizenship. He had a wife and 3 children and his own general store on Fillmore Street in San Francisco. He tended his store in 3-piece suits and kept his hair cut short with a part on the side. Bagai lost his citizenship in the crackdown on non-white immigrants. He was then stripped of the business he had built due to a California law restricting the economic rights of people who were not citizens. Shorn of a passport, he was then thwarted in his attempt to get back to India and was now a man without a country. Far from his original home and rejected by his new one, he rented a room in San Jose, turned on the gas, and took his life. He left a suicide note in which he lamented the futility of all that he had sacrificed to come to America. Obstacles this way, blockades that way, and bridges burnt behind. No matter which route a borderline applicant took to gain acceptance, the caste system shapeshifted to keep the upper caste pure by its own terms. What a thin, frayed thread held the illusions together. A Japanese novelist once noted that, on paper anyway, it was a single apostrophe that stood between rejection and citizenship for a Japanese O'Hara versus an Irish O'Hara. These cases laid bare not just the absurdity, but the inaccuracy of these artificial labels and the perception of purity or pollution implied by them. At the same time, they exposed the unyielding rigidity of a caste system, defiant in the face of evidence contrary to its foundation, how it holds fast against the assault of logic. Defining purity and the constancy of the bottom rung. As the middle castes pressed for admittance to the rungs above them, what was consistent was the absolute exclusion of the polluting lowest caste. African Americans were not just not citizens. They were, like their Dalit counterparts in India, forced outside the social contract. They and the Dalits bore the daily brunt of the taint ascribed to their very beings. The Dalits were not permitted to drink from the same cups as the dominant castes in India, live in the same villages of the upper caste people, walk through the front doors of upper caste homes, and neither were African Americans in much of the United States for most of its history. African Americans in the South were required to walk through the side or back door of any white establishment they approached. Throughout the United States, sundown laws forbade them from being seen in white towns and neighborhoods after sunset, or risk assault or lynching. In bars and restaurants in the North, though they might be permitted to sit and eat, it was common for the bartender to make a show of smashing the glass that a black patron had just sipped from. Heads would turn as restaurant patrons looked to see where the crashing sound had come from and who had offended the sensibilities of caste pollution. Untouchables were not allowed inside Hindu temples, and black Mormons in America, by way of example, were not allowed inside the temples of the religion they followed and could not become priests until 1978. Enslaved black people were prohibited from learning to read the Bible, or any book for that matter, just as untouchables were prohibited from learning Sanskrit and sacred texts. In churches in the South, black worshippers sat in the galleries or in the back rows, and when such arrangements were inconvenient to the dominant caste, the Negroes must catch the gospel as it escapes through the windows and doors from outside. To this day, Sunday morning has been called the most segregated hour in America. Well into the civil rights era, the caste system excluded African Americans from the daily activities of the general public in the South, the region where most of them lived. They knew to disregard any notice of a circus coming to town or of a political rally. Those things were not intended for them. They were driven from Independence Day parades, wrote the historian David Roediger, as defilers of the body politic. What a British magistrate observed about the lowest castes in India could as well have been said of African Americans. They were not allowed to be present at the great national sacrifices or at the feasts which followed them, wrote the colonial administrator and historian W.W. Hunter. They could never rise out of their servile condition, and to them was assigned the severest toil in the fields. Their exclusion was used to justify their exclusion. Their degraded station justified their degradation. They were consigned to the lowliest, dirtiest jobs, and thus were seen as lowly and dirty, and everyone in the caste system absorbed the message of their degradation. The burden fell on those in the lowest caste to adjust themselves for the convenience of the dominant caste whenever in contact with white people. An African American man who managed to become an architect during the 19th century had to train himself to read architectural blueprints upside down, wrote the scholar Charles W. Mills, because he knew white clients would be made uncomfortable by having him on the same side of the desk as themselves. Well into the 20th century, a panic could afflict people in the dominant caste if ever a breach occurred. A frantic white mother in civil rights era Mississippi yanked her young daughter inside one day, held her over the kitchen sink, and scrubbed her little hand with a Brillo pad, as if both their lives depended on it. The girl had touched the hand of a little black girl who was working on the family's land. The mother told her never to touch that girl's hand again, though that was not the term she used. "They have germs," the mother said. "They're nasty." The mother's fury frightened the little girl and brought her to tears as they stood there, bent over the sink. And the daughter's tears brought the mother to tears over the manufactured terror she had allowed to consume her, and over the box that she realized in that moment had imprisoned her for all of her life. This was a sacred prohibition, and it was said that into the 1970s, the majority of whites in the South had not so much as shaken the hands of a black person. A young, dominant caste man raised in the Depression era South had been well taught the rules of the caste system and adhered to them as expected. When he went north in the mid-20th century and joined the military, he had to confront the mythologies of his upbringing. Strange things pop up at us like gargoyles when we are liberated from our delusions, the white Southerner said. Up north, on occasion, he found himself in situations where Black people were permitted in the same work settings as whites. I thought I was entirely prepared, emotionally and intellectually, the man, an editor at Look magazine, recalled years later. But he discovered that he was a captive of his own conditioning, which he called a certain madness. Every time he reached the point where he had to shake hands with a Black person, he felt an automatic revulsion that had been trained into him. He recoiled, even though it had been Black women who had bathed him as a child, had mixed the dough for his biscuits, and whose touch had not repulsed him when extended in servitude. But with presumed equals. Each time I shook hands with a Negro, he said, I felt an urge to wash my hands. Every rational impulse, all that I considered best in myself, struggled against this urge. But the hand that had touched the dark skin had a will of its own and would not be dissuaded from signaling it was unclean. That is what I mean by madness. Pillar number 5. Occupational hierarchy, the Jatis and the Mudsil. When a house is being built, the single most important piece of the framework is the first wood beam hammered into place to anchor the foundation. That piece is called the mudsil, the sill plate that runs along the base of a house and bears the weight of the entire structure above it. The studs and subfloors, the ceilings and windows, the doors and roofing, all the components that make it a house, are built on top of the mudsil. In a caste system, the mudsil is the bottom caste that everything else rests upon.